ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Dr. Ann Jones here. I've been out and about recording nature sounds, but nature doesn't always oblige. For example, this wombat, yes, you, thought that my recorder was the perfect place to scratch its butt. So to find out what else that wombat got up to one night near Canberra, subscribe to Nature Sounds by Ann Jones on ABC Listen, on podcast apps, and also on the Wombat Butt Scratching Thumbs Up list.
Mother Earth, Mother Mary, the good mother. Is there a more impossible standard than motherhood itself? Hi, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid on ABC Radio National and across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia, the panel show about the things we believe. And why is it that every culture seems to believe in a mother who is endless in some way, endlessly patient or endlessly giving, endlessly present? In Christianity, we have Mary, the sinless virgin. In psychology, we have the so-called good mother, who's always available and calm, never faltering. In the 21st century, our image of the endless mother is the woman who looks like she can do it all, whether it's work or home, business or pleasure. And this week, where this ideal of perfection comes from, what it costs women who try to live up to it, and what it costs women who, by choice or circumstance, never become her at all. Our guests, Cristina Liedo Gomez, a theologian who's spent her career picking apart the church's construction of Mary. That's a job for you. We have Bronwyn Harman, a psychologist who coined the term good mother syndrome after interviewing thousands of Australian parents. And Cherie Joseph, a Sydney writer whose new memoir, Juicy, is wonderful. It's about wanting more than anything to become a mum and not becoming one. Welcome to you all. Bronwyn, in our Perth studio, let's start with you. Why are you so interested in motherhood?
I think it's just a subject that has been not really examined well over the years in research.
That's an odd thing for something that's been with us since before the species began.
Yes, it is. I think that we have been increasingly moving toward what I call the good mother syndrome, where mothers are held at an unrealistic ideal, put on a platform that they can't possibly stay on, and they're going to fall off sooner or later. It seems to be a social thing that is increasing more and more. Being a good mother, what we call a good mother, who's that perfect person in the textbooks that everybody hates, is a social construction. I try to explain to women in particular, because they're the ones who become mothers, that it's an impossible ideal, that they can't possibly be the good mother all the time. Eventually they're going to make a mistake because humans make mistakes.
I understand, but tell me about what underlies that. I mean, you being a mother yourself. So like strip away the construction, and what is your vision of motherhood?
I think mothers try to do everything they can for their children, but they often sacrifice a lot of things for their children and their families. And I'm not sure that it's always a good thing. I'm not always sure that it's always a good thing for the mothers themselves to constantly give things up for their children. It doesn't teach the children their own ability to sacrifice things for life.
That's interesting. Well, let's meet Cristina Liedo Gomez. Welcome, Cristina. The Catholic Church has a lot to say about motherhood. I mean, we start with Mary. The church had to come up with four separate ideas just to make Mary work: virgin and mother, sinless and human. What has this meant?
Yeah, look, before I get to that question, I actually want to answer the question that you're asking, Bronwyn, which is, where does this whole good mother thing how do we work with it and what is going on there? And I think what Bronwyn's pointing to is what maternal scholars call the good mother myth. And it's especially prevalent in Western societies where the good mother is, the sole caretaker of the child. And if the child turns out badly, everything is blamed upon the mother. But also this is part of the patriarchal agenda, which is that, you know, having this mother that is, you know, endlessly giving and not paid for it as well. It supports other ideologies like gender binarism. And this mother myth is part of a bigger structure that also supports capitalism too. So, you know, let's throw that in there too.
So what do you see, Christina, as the mother reality?
The mother reality is, as Bronwyn points to, she's a complex mother. And let's now turn to religion here. Unfortunately, in our imagination, you know, enforced by poetry, art, and religion itself, it's been reinforced in us, this like mother to a single child, mother to an infant. This is the ideal mother. But in fact, mothers are mothers to adult children, mothers to adolescent children, and the kind of mothering that's involved with that is different. And also mothers themselves can get angry and can get frustrated, and mothers are complex themselves. You don't see that complexity. What you see is just this flattened image of the mother as reinforced in religious images and in art, medieval art, in church documents themselves. So, and I've written about this a lot because it's men who have reflected on the mother, and it's their work that has been recorded and used and that we have had access to. It's only lately that we've now had women scholars who are starting to reflect on this, and not just women scholars, but scholars who are mothers who are challenging this flattened or, you know, singular image of the mother, particularly the mother to the infant child.
Let's welcome Cherie Joseph now. Hi, Cherie.
Hello.
Your memoir opens at the Festival of St. Anne on this little Italian island. Why did you choose the patron saint of the childless and the unmarried?
So I didn't actually choose it.
She chose you.
Yeah, exactly. No, she actually did. This was originally a part of my story that wasn't going to feature in the book. And I was trying to begin, I was told by my editor to try and start with a euphoric moment, somewhere where there's a bit of healing that's happened or some sort of resonant moment. The original beginning, which is actually the next part, it's a bit dark. And I think they wanted to sort of show that there's hope or something like that. So I was struggling to think of a scene, and then it sort of hit me and I started writing about this moment. The more I looked into it, I saw the connection around St. Anne and that being like all the symbolism that she held. And suddenly that felt like there was this long running thread throughout the book that had more of a spiritual undertone that kind of helped me understand my story a little and kind of gave it that gravitas. My middle name is Anne, and so is my grandmother's. And so there's this lineage as well. And I think it had a lot of prominence because we, especially for me being Lebanese Maronite, we're sort of raised to believe in these inherited narratives around motherhood as the only real path for a woman. And it's just never questioned if there's any other way, or we don't really have a lot of models for what to do and what that looks like in our lives. So it can be very hard to imagine life if you can't be a mother. And so this is sort of the heart of the book. It's like she's desperately trying to be, and then this is the struggle, and it's like, how do you get through that, and what does that look like?
Bronwyn Harmon in Perth, I'm sure this story resonates with you as a scholar and a human being.
I have heard that story many times because I have two areas of expertise. I have the good mother syndrome is one area, but the other area that I've recently completed my PhD in is attitudes toward people who don't have children. So this is something I've heard about a lot in the last 10 years or so that I've been studying this area, that the attitude toward women who don't, in particular, who don't have children is very negative, generally speaking.
Bronwyn, this idea of the sacred mother, does it come from religion? Because I'm thinking in almost pre-religious terms, we have, you know, infant attachment, you know, this sheer biological dependence of a newborn on a mother, not a father. Does this reverence come from that?
It's not just religion that it comes from. It comes from society in general as well. It's prevalent in our culture, our media, all the media is very pro-motherhood. Arts, government policy, religion, all aspects of life really.
And that term you used, like, it's very pro-motherhood in a way. Like, what could be wrong with that? What could be a counter-argument to that? It's like being pro-puppies, you know what I mean? It's a good thing.
Is it?
Well, this is what I'm trying to explore.
I think that being a mother and prescribing motherhood as being such a good thing is very limiting for women, especially for women who cannot be mothers or don't want to be mothers.
And what could encapsulate this more than this is, you know, some religions, the Immaculate Conception is a painless birth, you know what I mean? And any mother, I mean, talk about an unattainable, unachievable target, you know?
Absolutely.
Even with an epidural.
Absolutely. And yet women still strive to be that perfect mother. And this is what I'm trying to stop people from doing, is to explain to them that you can't be that perfect mother because we're human for a start. And secondly, by whose standards are we trying to be a perfect mother? The goalposts keep moving.
What do you say, Christina?
We're not like anti-mothers here. It's just, I guess, at least from my perspective, we just want to bring complexity into it. And also, we don't want to conflate motherhood with womanhood. Unfortunately, that's what we get in society and in religion. And, you know, as Bronwyn says, in policy, in every aspects of our living. And so, you know, we want to untangle those things. And we want to say that to be a woman, that ultimate womanhood doesn't imply that you have to be a mother. And, you know, even for my friends who are not mothers, it's so painful for them to have Mother's Day celebrated in churches and have mothers blessed. At the same time, we do want to thank our mothers, you know, especially mothers who've brought us up in difficult circumstances. So it's not anti-motherhood. It's just we want to bring complexity into this and we don't want to be boxed in.
Cherie, have you been in a church when Mother's Day is observed, or indeed when any aspect of motherhood is sanctified?
Not specifically in a church, but I do experience the Mother's Day, the grief around that. I think it's a grief I will carry for the rest of my life, and it's something I will always have to live with. But I do know that it gets easier and there are ways to deal with it. I think what everyone is trying to say here that's so interesting is it's the depiction that there's this simplified one. We don't really have any complexity to the topic. So it's, you know, it's the biological mother, it's the youthful mother, it's under the right circumstances, in the right marriage. And we're kind of ignoring the complexities of the way society has actually transformed, that it's becoming harder and harder to even want that dream, to even have that as a reality. It's becoming like, outside of just, you know, biological issues, there's also just, you know, societal struggles around relationships, and people, especially post-COVID, are struggling to communicate and know what they want and actually know what they're in for if they do pursue motherhood.
Cherie, you speak of grief. Is it possible for you to disentangle the grief you experienced at not being able to be a mum, a grief for the children who never were, versus the shame that was imposed on you by your society or your community or your culture or your church?
They do go hand in hand because the grief is its own, you know, feeling. I think outside of society, there was always that urge to be a mother and to be able to be there for people and that kind of feeling of looking after others, which I think, again, because we only have one depiction, we don't realize that there are so many ways to mother and to be in the community.
Exactly. So they don't need to go hand in hand. Grief doesn't have to have shame as its companion. It's hard enough to deal with by itself.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely doesn't have to be. In fact, that's what I try to unpack, is what makes it harder and how much of that is just these inherited narratives, which aren't just religious or even, I mean, cultural, but even amongst friends of mine who grew up in Australia from atheist families, they have the same pressures and they feel the same griefs. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also to do, because it's mixed up with aging and how we, you know, how women are perceived generally, that, you know, your worth is in being young and fertile. And I really wanted to push back on that notion, because I just think that from everything we've seen, it seems like life seems to start from much older for women. It's like 40, 50, 60. It's a new kind of era for so many of those women who are just coming into their own. And we ignore that because they're not considered mothers or, yeah.
Christina?
I was just thinking, all these things that, you know, we're critiquing, this is what Andrea O'Reilly, the maternal scholar, talks about the characteristics of patriarchal motherhood. She suggests that we instead look towards empowered mothering. And empowered mothering looks like the opposite of these things. Not expecting the mother to be there 24/7, not putting all the parenting duties on the mother, that the mothering is actually shared by a community, not just the sole responsibility of the one person, the mother. But in terms of, I guess, like the contribution of religion, particularly Christianity, image of the mother, this eternal mother, eternally giving, you know, selfless, all of that was reinforced through the image of Mary. And we had the whole B.A. Santa Maria movement, which reinforced that as well. So, you know, it is part of our Australian imaginary, unfortunately, this non-complex mother, this singular mother promoted through the image of a non-complex Mary.
Brahman, do you want to have a say here?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm not anti-motherhood either, obviously, being a mother myself. I'm anti making mothers feel guilty for being mothers. Mm. That mothers are often made to feel guilty about things that they shouldn't be made to feel guilty about. For example, you can't win the argument about cloth nappies or disposable nappies because whatever you choose is going to be wrong. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether you choose breastfeeding or bottle feeding, it's going to be wrong. Mm-hmm. Whatever you do is going to be wrong anyway, no matter what you choose. So I'm trying to tell mothers just do what you want because you're going to be wrong anyway somewhere. Mm. And the public seem to be very happy to tell you what you're doing wrong, when you, especially when you're a young mother. And it depends on how many children you have. By the time you have your third or fourth, you sort of don't listen to those comments. But it's very effective when you have public opinion commenting on your parenting when you're a first-time mother and a new mother. You're very vulnerable. Mm. And it's a very good way of manipulating women in particular, of how they should behave and how they should act.
I mean, that's a strong word, manipulate.
Absolutely, they're manipulated. It's a form of oppression. It's a form of social oppression. It's a social control technique.
And Bronwyn, even though we're increasingly secular, do you believe we still carry a sort of secular sanctification for mothers? That they're just judged less on piety now and more on performance? How are you performing on your cloth nappy challenge or your breastfeed challenge or whatever it is that's the latest impossible goal for you to meet?
Definitely. I think that they are judged all the time in different groups.
Well, on ABC Radio National, this is God Forbid. We're looking at motherhood, the challenges and expectations we place on women with and without children. We are with theologian Christina Liedo Gomez. We are with psychologist, researcher in psychology, Bronwyn Harman. And we are with writer and memoirist Cherie Joseph. Christina, you've written about Indigenous mothering traditions, you know, Earth Mother showing its reciprocity to humanity.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't speak for all Indigenous communities, but I will say that even, you know, from my upbringing as a Filipina, because I migrated here when I was 9, you know, mothering actually belonged to the whole community that lived with you. And, you know, the people that lived with me was my grandparents, my aunts, uncles, you know, everybody pitched in. There wasn't this everything is up to the mother to bring up the child. And also I had the privilege of having maids as well. So, you know, you come to the Western space and it's a singular mother. It's the mother at home with the baby and all the pressure is upon her. This is why you find mothers who are isolated, lonely, you know, with deep depression. I remember when I had my first child, I rang the hotline and said, you know, I think I'm depressed. And the nurse on the other line said, honey, all women who give birth are depressed. And I was thinking, this is not very helpful. But, you know, it was because all the burden was on me. And I just thought if I was in the Philippines, there would have been so many people helping me out.
I was just going to say that that's partly why it's such an idea in our minds that we should be mothers, is that I grew up in exactly the same, you know, all the cousins and all the aunties and everyone's involved in your life. And there's all these milestones that to be celebrated is to go through the traditional, you know, marriage, having babies, baptisms. That's what we know to be something to celebrate. And so, of course, we think that that's the only way. It's so normalized, and we don't question or think. When I'm around my friends and they actually are struggling because they are on their own, it's a completely different situation still for my family members who just have help all the time. They can leave the kids with various family members. Everyone knows everyone's business. It makes it so much easier. But I think it's harder even in Western, like when we've migrated, to maintain that, because you are in silos more, and especially after COVID, it was much harder to just drop in and see people.
But that's what's so beautiful about your memoir, Cherie, is because you have, although you mightn't use the word, a new family, and they have a new family in you, your girlfriends, your communal friends, your what they now call in modern parlance your chosen family. And when, you know, when your dad died, when you had relationship breakdown, when other huge traumas came into your life, did you have a kind of support that extended Maronite communal family with all its baptisms and weddings and funerals could then provide you, just without the bells and whistles that come with church life?
I think they definitely understood the complexity of my situation. They could see that I was trying to live that particular life. They knew that this was an unconventional path. And I think even though it was difficult for the extended family and community to really understand what was happening, they've definitely been trying to, and they've definitely been able to show up in other ways and to sort of recognize that, okay, this is what it looks like. I guess someone has to carve out the different paths because it's not that common. And I think they have a lot of fear, like what happens to a woman if she doesn't go down that path? Because they don't always know, or they only see a limited amount of people do that, it's harder for them to, they do fear for you and they worry, but you do sort of broaden your horizons. You have that extended friendship circles. You have time and capacity to actually be there for so many people, and you start to realize what it means to actually look for and build community just outside of the inherited structures. And then you've got roles like auntie, uncle, being there for friends, godmothers, godparents, just showing up. You even have time for activism. You have time to really just do things to help people, because you're not sort of bound by trying to have a particular life. You're just kind of letting life happen.
Brahman.
I was going to say that one of the problems with women who don't have children, when they meet up with family and friends, although some are very supportive, I've heard a lot from women in my research that motherhood is conflated with womanhood. And people who don't have children, women who don't have children, aren't seen to be real adults. They don't have the responsibilities of adulthood, apparently, because they don't have children. Apparently, they don't have any responsibilities. They can just flit off to whoever they like, whenever they want. Seemingly, they don't do that all the time. They don't flit off and have holidays at whim. And it's usually women who don't have children, or sometimes men who don't have children, but particularly women who don't have children in the workplace, are often assumed to be the ones who can work public holidays or overtime or Christmas or whatever. Often parents are given the first choice of having holidays because they have a family. And so it's very linear, what we call family, instead of having the huge community like Cherie's talking about. Often people look at it, if you don't have children, you don't really have a family, which I don't think is true.
How can one bypass this?
It's so ingrained, I don't know that we are going to ever be able to bypass it. It's been ingrained for centuries.
Name it first.
Yes, call it out first and label it and bring people's attention to it happening, because as Cherie said, it's often things are happening without people realising that's happening.
Christina?
You know, Bron was talking about how mothers already worry about things like, oh, should I give them the plastic nappy or the natural nappy or the cloth nappy? And this is called mother guilt in maternal scholarship. And, you know, mothers already have that. And I think that, you know, advertisers understand that too. And so they use that vulnerability to sell their products. So, you know, no matter, even if you have the mother who does all the things that she's supposedly supposed to do, she'll always still feel guilty. Somehow it's kind of ingrained in us. This is my experience of motherhood and talking to other mothers. We're constantly worried about our children. So to have that added pressure, you know, have the right cot, have the right safety equipment, have the right this and that, you know, part of the complexity of this is in advertising and in people trying to sell products to you, they play on that vulnerability.
I agree with Christina completely that there is a level of guilt in motherhood already.
Yep.
You want your child to have the best. You want to give them the very best. You know you've only got one shot at it.
Mm.
So there's already a level of guilt.
Mm.
We're adding in a level of capitalism now that they do play on it. They, if you want your child to be the greatest child in school, you have to have these books or this calculator or this backpack or whatever.
Yep.
And don't bring me on to Mother's Day and the commercialization around that.
Yeah.
Bronwyn, but this is really important. You know, you talk about a natural or innate guilt of a mother who is forced by structures and societies and cultures to deal with an imposed guilt. Is it important to disentangle the two precisely so the woman, the mother, the parent can engage with that authentic guilt that you speak of?
I try and convince mothers to not listen to the voices in the background and the voices in the television and everywhere else, the media that tells them they need this product or that product, and to trust their own intuition when it comes to being a mother to make the best choice they can for their children.
Even when that own voice, that own intuition says, I have let my kids down precisely because I'm not a perfect mother.
Yes, and that's what I'm trying to stop women from thinking, because they don't let their kids down. They think they let their kids down, but we all make mistakes.
How do we deal with those mistakes without the shame? Because one doesn't want to be shameless. We doesn't want to say, no, I'm not going to listen to these voices, and then fail to deal with the reality. As you put it, we all make mistakes.
I don't know how we extricate the two. I'm not sure how we stop commercialization of motherhood or guilting them.
I guess, Christina, what I'm trying to get to is there a good guilt versus a bad guilt?
I mean, of course, you know, admission of doing wrong is important too. Like, we can't just go around going, oh, I'll do whatever I like and then wreck the world. Yeah. So, yeah, there is a kind of important aspect to this of admitting when you've got it wrong. But also part of this is the acceptance that you'll probably get it wrong at some stage, because if you don't ever get it wrong, then you're not human, right?
So
the important thing is to say, okay, I've done it wrong this time. This is part of the journey. This is part of the learning process, and I'll know better next time. You know, this is, but unfortunately, you know, you do get that message as a mother, like you have to get it right at the first time. And if you don't, you've wrecked the child's life forever. They're going to be in psychological rooms.
You need to allow yourself to make a mistake.
Yeah.
Admit you made a mistake. Know what you could have done and do better.
Yeah.
And know that you have not broken your child.
Yeah.
They're very resilient. Children are very resilient. You can make mistakes and they come back. That's okay. They're fine.
Yeah.
But then you know that next time you shouldn't do A, B, C. You should do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And learn from it. Admit you make a mistake, because that's how children learn as well. If you try to be the perfect mother and you are the perfect mother, that doesn't allow the children to make mistakes.
Mm. Mm.
Children learn by watching their parents.
Mm.
So if you make a mistake, it's how you deal with that mistake that the child remembers and learns from.
Mm.
So we don't want perfect mothers anyway, because they bring up children who are broken.
Yeah.
What lessons, Cherie, have you learned on your journey?
So I think one of the most interesting stats that we're seeing at the moment is by 2030, they're claiming that almost half of women will be, I think it's like 45% or even more than that, will be without, will be single without children. So I think the entire landscape of society is changing so drastically. And so it's not even a question of you wanted kids and it couldn't happen or you chose not to. I think it's just more and more we're seeing alternative ways of living our lives.
Not only life without a baby, but life without a man.
Yes, exactly. Oh, well, yes.
You won't know what to do.
Well, that's what they try and tell us, but I don't know. There's a lot of fear mongering. But what I'm realizing is there's just so many narratives that we've never questioned. And it's not until you're in that position that you, I feel like the world just opens up and we realize there's so many things. Like I feel like a lot of people go into these stages of life without really knowing what they're in for. It's like you're kind of sleepwalking into it, and that's just what you do. You don't question it. And then you're in for a, oh, look at how hard it is. Look at how I'm treated. Even when I do it right, I'm still shamed or guilted. Mm. And then I find that when you're on the other side or you're realizing, you just see how much of it is actually just made up, you know, and that you, I feel like you have more agency than you realize, that you can actually choose a different life, decide how your life is going to be and prioritize certain things, like understanding what your values are and really understanding that there's so many ways to live a life. For me, I realized that being a mother, I could still get that from community and finding other ways of other projects. Birthing a book is a way of a different kind of way of creating something and channeling creativity into that. And also just there's so many ideas about life here around, you know, well, your age is this, you're off the cliff. And then in when I was traveling, nobody cared about your age. Nobody cared about the same sort of things. People just wanted to live their life, enjoy their life, find what mattered to them. And so it really opened up things from that sort of closed perspective of this is the only way to live your life.
And this liberation that you're speaking about is not a new thing feminists have come up with. You reach back to the Mesopotamian goddess Inanna in your book, who is stripped of everything at the gates of the underworld. You die alone, but you are free. It's a myth of liberation, but there's truth in myth, yeah?
Yes, it's a kind of myth around ego death. You know, you can be at the top of your game as the goddess Inanna was and beloved by all and very powerful and all-ruling, and then you hear the call and it's the call to, oh, someone's calling me, it's my sister, my shadow self, and you have to basically go through the seven gates to the underworld. And I love that idea of just progressively shedding something at each gate until you get to the end, kind of like humbled and surrendering, and then to sort of come back to life, that you need someone to come and save you and see your pain reflected back. And I just love the idea of that rebirth and coming back to the world transformed and kind of understanding what the underworld can be. And so I loved having that as like a scaffolding to the story, because it felt like a story that has been lived before, but it also had such there were new lessons. There were things about this very particular time that I think no one has really lived, like with COVID and just a world that is changing drastically, you know, and so much of it is out of our control. And I think that makes it so much harder. But if we have this framework, if we understand that we'll get through, that we can sort of be resilient and survive almost anything, I feel like that, you know, that gives us something like a kind of allegory or something to kind of understand how to do that better and just give us a bit of hope for the future, which I think is a bit bleak at the moment.
Yes. When you realize you are utterly alone, the awakening comes that you are connected to all the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that story because it's actually, it's a myth that's been influenced a lot of stories, like how we tell the stories. There's a lot of themes like the resurrection of Jesus, the 3 days, there's like common, I think they were telling those stories for so long that that was the framework for how they told their stories and how they found meaning in them. So I just loved that synergy.
Well, that brings us neatly to our blame Catholicism section. And Cristina Liedo Gomez.
Oh, look, I was just thinking as you were speaking, Cherie, that, if we look at Christianity, everything is placed on Mary. Mary brought up Jesus. But actually, you know, I write about this. You know, what about...
She co-parented.
Yeah.
I mean, he had work to do.
Yeah, he had work to do. He had Joseph. He had... I'm sure there were midwives as well at the birth of Mary. Like, surely it wasn't just Jesus, Mary and Joseph in the stable. And it's not even a stable. Anyway, we won't go into there. That was introduced by St. Francis of Assisi. But, you know, like there's this perception of this, the family is just mother, father and child. That's already an ideology when actually family is much bigger than that.
But isn't that just another prescribed cultural norm, just a norm you prefer or maybe even idealize?
I just don't think that we should put all the pressure on the one person to bring up the child. Even when the parents do it the best that they can, you know, there are other influences on the child. So to blame anything on the parents, you know, to say that the parents didn't do a good job bringing up the child, like that's unfair because there's other influences. You know, unfortunately, we've also had this image of Mary as submissive, you know, the ideal mother. The most important thing that she does is she gives birth to, you know, God's self. But actually, you know, the other side of Mary, the empowered Mary, I mean, her very name, Miriam, actually means resistance. We don't see that kind of Mary. And that kind of Mary is not promoted. But as I've written on this, I have said that even the way that Mary is used, the whole study of Mary, Mariology, all the dogmas, there's four dogmas on her, they're all not really about, you know, the woman or anything. This is about Jesus. This is about ensuring that the church understands what it is, its identity. And still the way that Mary is projected is this image of perfect motherhood, which then doesn't help other women because especially if you've grown up with this Marian faith and this is the only kind of faith you understand, then I actually had a very ambivalent relationship to Mary once I started to learn how Mary was used by men to promote their own agendas about what good and perfect womanhood is. So I don't even think that some men understand that themselves.
How would you like to reclaim Mary then?
Oh, Mary is definitely not this submissive woman by any means. And we see that in the Magnificat, you know. She talks about overthrowing the rich and throwing them from their seat of power. And she said this Magnificat as soon as she met up with her cousin Elizabeth. And, you know, two pregnant women announcing the overthrow of empire. Like, this is like, you know, this is empowered women. This is not submissive women just following whatever men tell them what to do.
The other thing about Mary, while we're there, she was a refugee fleeing with a newborn baby.
Yes. And there's actually an American artist that's portrayed this. It's really good. Yeah. See, you know, that kind of Mary, that Marian image, that's not prevalent, but actually she was a refugee. She was running away from the violence that was enacted on the other babies because, you know, Herod had heard about this new king that was born in his empire and he was afraid that he would overthrow him.
Well, on ABC Radio National, we are with theologian Cristina Liedo Gomez. We are with psychologist, researcher in psychology, Bronwyn Harman. And we are with writer and memoirist, Cherie Joseph. This is God Forbid. We're looking at motherhood. Bronwyn, in our Perth studio, we use the language of parenting rather than mothering or fathering. Does that lose anything in the chain?
No. I think that parenting is much better than mothering or fathering on many levels in that it takes away the responsibility for one person to be in charge of bringing up the child. When I remember when my kids were little, I went out one day to go shopping and left the kids at home with my husband. And because it's better to go shopping by yourself, you don't buy so much in the supermarket, I can tell you that much. And I got home and my husband's friend was there. He was a single man, no children or anything. And he said, wasn't it nice of my husband to babysit for me? Well, I ripped him a new one, I can tell you that. He babysit his own children. What do you mean? I mean, and it wasn't even like I was going out having a jolly good time. I was out doing the grocery shopping. It's not fun.
And you gave him $10 an hour?
Yeah. Yes, he got what for. I can guarantee he never brought that up again. He never said babysit your children again.
Well, obviously parenting is preferable in that sense because mothers and fathers are both parents.
Yes.
But is there anything innate or inherent or gendered to this experience that we need to be mindful of at the same time?
I think we need to be mindful of the fact that when we start to assign roles to mothers and roles to fathers, that we're reinforcing stereotypes.
Regardless.
Because apart from having the good mother syndrome, of course, we also have the good father syndrome. Good fathers don't worry about parenting. Good fathers go out and they earn the bread. They're breadwinners. They're the ones who bring in the finances. So that's why they're not expected to be good fathers as such. You know, they're not expected to look after their children because they're out earning the money, apparently.
But if you strip away those rules, we still need to find, and this is a challenge for me myself as a father of three boys, what is a good father if you ignore and turn your ear off to all those voices?
We're back to the same things as before. The same things as mothers. Good fathers are ones who try their very best to bring up their children and make mistakes and explain their mistakes and move on.
So there's no gendered component whatever?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Can I jump in there?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I do think we need to consider the rise of toxic masculinity and the rise of trad wives. And, you know, I was speaking to my son about this and I said, you know, what's a way to help, you know, some of these young men who seem to be taken by these social media influences and listening to this toxic masculinity and normalizing it. And my son said, having good role models. And I know he said to me, he looks towards myself and my husband as role models of what it is to be a good citizen. But I think he also particularly looks towards his dad, who, you know, doesn't present as like macho. My husband isn't into cars and, you know, these so-called things that men are supposed to be into. So I think we've done the best that we can with my son, but, you know, he's not into toxic masculinity. He's not taken by these things. And I think it comes down at least, you know, in part to good role models.
Cherie, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, I actually do. I wanted to say that the toxic masculinity problem, that's a big issue in as to why it's becoming harder for women and everyone to sort of settle down into long-term relationships, because I think that they're becoming very siloed from the podcasts they listen to and the radicalization online as well. That's making it worse. But we've always kind of had the Madonna whore complex. Mm. That's always been a factor, and it's a really a prominent thing that you mentioned about Mary. I loved that, the Magnificat, because the fact that we only have this one portrayal of Mary and even Mary Magdalene being so, you know, shamed and seen as, you know, not actually given, we don't really know her story, but we know that she played a much bigger role. But I think that all of that does play into seeing women as too much and needing to be tamed and needing to be, and a lot of that is like, that's why you're this way to be a mother, or this is the right way, you know, don't sleep around, like all the rules we impose on women. Mm. But there's literally, when you look at it, there's no way. There is actually no way to exist without criticism. It's almost like no matter what you do, there is going to be something. And it even has gone right around that now the trad wives are, they've got the ire and they're under the fire. But it's like I think we just have a problem with women at the end of the day.
Yes.
That's just it. Yeah.
It's just not that you just can't be a good mother. It's also you can't be a good woman, really. Yeah. I agree with you, Cherie, that, you know, if you either sleep around or you're a frigid bitch. You know, you can't win either way. We judge constantly.
Yeah.
And we could never seem to get it right.
Yeah. And unfortunately, reinforced again with the Mary-Eve dichotomy, which unfortunately is in the Christian tradition, which feminist theologians have torn apart. Unfortunately, that scholarship is not as prevalent as this virgin whore archetype image, yeah, that's more prevalent.
There's so many reinforcements, and even if you look at society in general, you look at the media. How many times in the media do you hear a story where a woman is described as a mother when it's irrelevant to the story? You'll have a story such as we had one a while ago here in Perth. A policewoman was attacked while on duty, but she was described as a mother. A mother was attacked while she was on duty as a policeman, policewoman. So it's not relevant to the story. She was attacked as a woman. Whether she was a mother or not is not relevant. And it seems to be added in as a, well, if she was a mother, she must be a nice person, you know, because she has children. So she's not one of those evil people who don't have children, who eat them for breakfast or whatever. Yeah. It's the fact that she was a mother, it made it seem worse, apparently, that she was attacked.
Yeah.
And it's not relevant to the story.
Yeah, and let's not forget about the flack Julia Gillard got for not choosing motherhood and choosing prime ministership.
Yeah. She was barren.
Yeah.
Not just barren, yeah. Bronwyn. Two words that Senator Heffernan used. She was deliberately barren.
Yes. Ooh, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Which is to you know, which is has a double layered meaning.
It's like women who don't have children who are not just cat ladies, they're crazy cat ladies. You know, it's a similar thing. It's an underlining.
Yeah.
And it's the same, you know, J.D. Vance, when he was running for vice president, labelled Jennifer Aniston and Taylor Swift, who were anti-Trump, as just being crazy cat women, and therefore dismissing them as being irrelevant because they're obviously not relevant because they don't have children. Therefore, they're not worthy of commenting on.
Mm.
You're young, Cherie. Do you remember that Julia Gillard stuff?
I do. And I think we take for granted that we have these role models, but we don't know that's how significant it is at the time. I think the discourse back then was we were just so behind in so many ways, but it really was about how dare you just not choose to be a mother.
Mm.
And there was no other option. Like if you struggled or you were trying or you couldn't find love, like there's no language for that. We didn't really even think of that. It was just how dare you choose that. But now I think more and more people are choosing it because the way things are, it's almost like there's no other option, or it's like they've really thought about it. Like if they're choosing that, they've really looked at the options and they've said, that's not for me. And I'm opting out because I know that if I did that, it would be worse for me. And so I just think we should be applauding all the different ways that life can be and showing what that looks like. There's such a limited idea of the cat lady trope is so funny because in our culture, we just don't talk about the women where it doesn't happen for them, but I feel like they're living their own sort of private lives. I think the stigma is in our community, it's like, well, they're just going to live with their parents, they're going to be the caretakers, and they're not going to have any type of life, and it's very sad. How sad. And when I speak to the ones in my community who are like in that sort of position, it's like they're living secret lives that no one realizes are amazing. They're just like, they've got time for themselves, their hobbies, they like do things for the community, they get to travel, they have great relationships with their nieces, nephews, the children in their communities. It's just incredible. And it's like nobody knows. It's like this little secret. And I just feel like if we knew that there were so many other ways, I think it's increasingly, and it feels like that next generation is heading in that direction. They're sort of, you know, realizing that this is actually, it's fun. It's amazing to have options and be able to focus on your passions, your dreams, your projects, be able, just open to all these new experiences. And I think a lot of men are very triggered by that. Like they're seeing that more and more, and you're seeing in the comment sections online, they're just so angry that there are women who are having a good time despite the challenges, because it's not all fun. I mean, there are challenges, but they're making it work for them, you know? And I think there's such beauty and power in where it's heading. But I think some people are being left behind because they don't realize where we're at.
You agree, Christina?
I was just actually just thinking, you know, it comes down back again to, you know, the judgment of these women, you know, oh, you're having a good time, you know, you shouldn't be, and, you know, you should be contributing to society. And your ultimate contribution, because you have a womb, is that you must, you know, be a mother. And, you know, that even in itself, this assumption that, you know, you're a woman, you know, it's easy enough for you to be a mother, takes away the complexity of the fact that there's different genders, there's women with complications with having babies. So, you know, no one really sees that.
Also, we have, you know, donor conception, we have egg freezing, and we have IVF and the nightmare or the opportunity or whatever that can be. I guess a final question to each of you, where do you want Australia, the world, to be in a generation or two from now with respect to motherhood? Maybe Bronwyn, you first.
I'd like to see us get to a point where we just leave mothers alone to get on with it and let women who don't have children get on with it. I'd like to see women not judged by their reproductive cycle and judged by what they do or do not do with their womb. That's where I'd like to be.
And Cherie, we all have a path. This is the thing we miss. You know, all of us are on a path, chosen or not, and we all have the challenges and the despair and the joy that goes with it.
Yeah, I think just no matter what path or whatever happens to you, that you find the thing that works for you, the joy that you know that is there, it's there for the taking. I feel like we're sort of locked in these prisons of our own making. It's not just society. I think it's also that we tell ourselves, this is the only way for my life to go. I have no other options. I'm just going to live in this sort of pain. You do, and you really, you can just walk out any time of this prison. You know, you can decide tomorrow that you're going to live a different life on your terms. And I think I just want people to know that no matter what happens, that there's that option for you. There is a hope there that is available.
Sounds like you've learned from the grief and pain of, you know, your father's loss, your relationship breakdown, and you coming to terms with your inability to have kids.
I felt like I had no other choice.
You didn't, but would you give up the wisdom?
Oh, no. I think it was the survival for me. It was really like I got to the point where I thought there's no point to my life if I can't do things as I thought it was meant to be. And there's something so lonely and devastating about getting to that point. And I know there's so many women that have that same feeling. And I think when you get to that point, you really have to look around you and you need to see, like, how do I be back in my life? Like, how do I fully live in it, not just kind of sleepwalk through it as I was told to, but what does it mean to really be in it and live your life? That's the thing.
There's something there for all of us, Christina.
Well, if, on my part, I just think that especially with the prevalence of AI and the, you know, it's really easy to just access ChatGPT, even when you're trying not to access it, it's just there. I think the most important thing for us is to ensure that we inform ourselves and inform ourselves with, like, you know, peer-reviewed research or information from different perspectives, not just like the one little channel that affirms your own beliefs. You know, be prepared to be challenged, but also, you know, be ready to question too. Question even your own beliefs. I think that's the most important thing that we need to do right now is to learn critical thinking and learn to question and be open to questions.
As much from our doctor as from our theologian?
Yes, definitely.
Well, that brings us to the end of a most informative and enjoyable God Forbid, with thanks to our guests, Christina Bronwyn and Cherie. Cherie Joseph, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Cherie Joseph's memoir is just out. The Ink is Wet. Juicy is the name. She's a Sydney writer. And Bronwyn Harmon in our Perth studio, a psychologist, researcher, who she's interviewed thousands of Australian parents, and I'm pleased to say I've interviewed her. Thank you, Bronwyn.
Thank you very much. It was very informative and enjoyable. Thank you.
And Christina, thanks for being a part of it as well.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this. Thanks for inviting me.
Christina Liedo Gomez is a theologian who's spent her career trying to work out how to understand the church's construction of Mary. Thanks to producer Amanda Roberts, technical production from Tim Jenkins. I'm James Carlton. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.